Okay, welcome to Wabanaki Windows. I'm your host, Donna Loring. Our topic today is Wabanaki veterans and their stories in recognition of the 80th anniversary of the end of World War II and the 75th anniversary of the end of the Korean War. So my guests are Professor Harold Prince, emeritus at Kansas State University, Professor Dan Ranko, a member of the Penobscot Nation, professor of anthropology and chair of Native American studies at the University of Maine. So let's begin with an overall background of Wabanaki military history. And this can like go back to, I don't know, 17, 1800s when we first started in these wars. So as usual, Harold, I'm gonna let you start.
Yes, Don, I'm glad that you remember the fact that 75 years ago, the Korean War had started with a invasion across the line. Actually, it was a complicated story in Korea that in 1945, and as you mentioned, 80 years ago, World War II ended. But the roots of the Korean War were laid, you could say, in 1945. There was just a conflict waiting to happen. And so 6 years after World War II, the Korean War broke out in part because the line that was drawn between North Korea, what became North Korea and South Korea, which used to be the Korean Kingdom, it was one united entity of the Korean people, the Korean nation, and it was artificially divided along the 75th parallel, if I remember that correctly. It was one of those parallels that crossed right through the peninsula. And so the northern part became, therefore, under Russian and indirectly Chinese communist influence. But in the south were also a lot of communist forces. So there was an effort in the 1950s, early 1950s, to reunite the Korean peninsula under one flag. But the Americans then, who were primarily based in Japan, then realized that the uprising in the south and the invasion from north, what became North Korea, had to be stopped. And so that happened in late June 1951. At that time, the American army was very small, relatively speaking. Right after World War II, the American armed forces had sharply been reduced. And so the Americans were really caught off guard in Korea. And because the Americans were allied with in NATO, but also with Australia and New Zealand, for example, there was a combined force, primarily American, but also Canadian troops, even Dutch troops were involved in the Korean War. From the New Zealand area, I'd like to mention is most people forget that Maori troops in the New Zealand Army were involved in the Korean War. And then, of course, a lot of other colonized indigenous peoples in Canada and the United States as well. So we are talking about the commemoration of these wars and ends of wars. Wars easily can happen. It happened in World War I. A whole series of escalating moments occurred, starting with a assassination of a Austrian monarch in or an heir in Sarajevo that happened in 1914, and a whole series of things happened that got us into World War I, ditto in World War II with the crossing of the German army into Poland because of treaties obligations. The French and the British then got into the war. The Americans waited until a massive bombing of Pearl Harbor by the Japanese also to join. And then, as I just mentioned, the Korean War again was a slip, and then the Vietnam War was a slip. In other words, all these things are slipped into war, and they're very difficult to resolve. And the reason why we're talking about Wabanaki and American and Canadian Indians in general is that they've found themselves in a crazy situation where their own rights to their own ancestral lands, most of which were stolen and invaded and stolen by either treaty or simply by annexation, that indigenous peoples in North America, when called upon action, drafted or in many cases, that they fought these wars when the injustice on their own homelands were profound.
So there's a disproportionate race-wise about how many served. Darren, you want to say something about that?
Oh no, I think you know the it's really important. I mean, we've gone over this at times in the last couple of shows, like, you know, the reasons for Wabanaki people to serve, you know, and I think I'm reminded, you know, you and Donald Sacktoma wrote, you know, an opinion piece for the Bangor Daily News in the last year or so, talking about the reasons for Wabanaki and other indigenous people serving in the U.S. military as an expression of protecting our own homelands, our own ways of life, our freedoms, even when the U.S. or Canada did not see to return the favor. You know, I think that fundamental fact, which has been mobilized, you know, all the way through, and we talked in the last show, or, you know, since the Revolutionary War, why we as Wabanaki folks sided with the Americans in this very tense and ongoing set of relations with the British, you know, culminating in things like scalp proclamations, but just you know, frontier wars of attrition in the 18th century. That we definitely saw, you know, the enemy of my enemy might be my friend, you know, too, is part of the rationale. And we talked about Chief Orono last time making, you know, building relations, and you have the Passamaquoddies in the by, you know, so Chief Orono 1775, you have the Passamaquoddies in the and the years following, working with Washington and Colonel his Colonel Allen, building, you know, relationships of mutuality, despite us being in 1776 called merciless Indian savages in the Declaration of Independence. I can only assume that they were referring to other Indians, because we were already in peace and friendship and collaboration treaties with the Americans. So it's an interesting set of racial and other dynamics around that. Right from the beginning, that tension of, like, we are fighting for our interests as Wabanaki people in coalition with, partnership with this, with the Americans, the upstarts in the 18th century, but then through subsequent wars where we even use our fighting to protect our homelands and in collaboration with American forces, as in some ways rationale to protect our own sovereignty, right? And that's a really important thing that's articulated in the Passamaquoddy letter about being exempted from the Citizenship Act in 1920, but also Lewis Mitchell's speech to the state legislature in the 1880s, to the Maine state legislature, talking about, hey, we've fought with you in all of these wars, but we do that as sovereigns. Like, we do that as protecting our own interests in collaboration with you, and not as a sort of giving up on our project as Passamaquoddy, Penobscot, or whoever. And so I just really want to bring that home, that there is this fundamental tension, right, that we are fighting, especially in the World War II, like other racialized people in the United States, right, at the time, fighting for freedoms and rights that, you know, many veterans of these wars came back to the United States without, you know, recognition of full rights or full citizenship or the ability to participate fully in the democracy. And I think that's a really fundamental part of that. And then the greater effect, too, of especially if we look at World War II and Korea, the impacts on our communities as sort of highlights of making connections and building connections with other indigenous people.
Yeah. Harold?
Yeah, Darren was just talking about tensions, and tensions are produced by internal contradictions that are not really resolved. And so you see a whole series of crazy internal contradictions, such as the utilization for propaganda purposes by the military of the fighting spirit of American Indians, right? So here you see the whole warrior idea that comes back in the movies with Fort Apache, John Wayne, and the whole thing, but also well before is this image of the American Indian as the freedom fighter. And that image was already taken on. We earlier talked about Joseph Orono, but just before Joseph Orono in 1775 went to Watertown for purposes of declaring an alliance with the American colonists rising up in rebellion against the British Crown, we of course have the so-called Tea Party, a term that has come to the fore in recent years with an American isolationist movement, so-called Tea Party in American public, in the American Republic. But that was, of course, a form of Pretendian. That's a term that we also used earlier. But you could use that term for Sam Adams and his men when they disguised themselves, in quotation marks, as American Indians when they did the raid on the tea ships in Boston Harbor. So here you see an act of rebellion by American colonists, but disguising themselves as American Indians. In other words, they were early on Pretendians, right? Pretend Indians by dressing up. And that repeatedly we've talked about before in the uprisings in Maine by white squatters, again, pretending to be Indian as freedom-loving, nature-loving fighters for their natural freedoms. And so that idea is already embedded in the American Revolution. And that comes strongly back in World War II when you see, for example, in the 1st Airborne Division, you see, or, yeah, 1st Airborne Division, 101st Airborne Division, you see a parachute infantry regiment that has adopted the war as a warrior cry when they jump out of the planes over Normandy, Geronimo, right? Geronimo, a famous Apache war chief. Then you get helicopters named after these tribes, in particular Plains Indian tribes, but warships, many warships named after Indian tribes. And so the whole set of American Indian imagery, in part fueled by Hollywood movies, is used by the Department of Defense in order to stir up the feelings of national pride and the fight against fascism, freedom, the oppression elsewhere, communism, and so forth. And so the irony is, of course, that American Indians are their imagery is being used as mascots and so forth, at the same time that the political apparatus is denying that the tribes their rights. And so right after World War II, when massive numbers of American Indians and Canadian Indians are fighting, there's an active effort to eradicate the tribal status and the reservation lands of American Indians under the Indian Termination Act. And so here are these contradictory forces that, on the one hand, is the exploitation of both the heritage of Native Americans and the using of American Indian flesh and blood for to fight the wars. At the same time, the movement to suppress their rights as American Indians and become assimilated into mainstream America. And so that's that ongoing tension that I think is a recurrent component of all our radio discussions about all these kind of issues, because they all come together. And as Darren, as a fellow anthropologist, knows, of course, that when anthropologists talk about culture, we talk about that complex whole that includes, and then you have both ideology, the way we think about things, the social organization, as well as the infrastructure in terms of how people make their living. And one way in which American Indians were rallied to serve, that's not just out of patriotism or out of complicated ideological factors. It's often a reason for economics. There's a reason why the poor disproportionately serve and the rich disproportionately get to talk about it while sitting at home and making careers at Wall Street or wherever they are staying. And so repeatedly you see that the poverty in which American Indians have been pushed also makes them the most likely candidates to be recruited in the armed forces.
Darren?
Yeah, I think That's a really good point. I think that especially with the World War II and Korean veterans in our communities, like that pathway to economic more economic security and independence, like definitely shaped our communities in really specific ways where many of the leaders in the aftermath of World War II and Korea from that emerged in our communities that also charted, potentially new futures that led to different kinds of outcomes, at times or many attempts around this come from, even some of the connections. And I think, Harold, you've made these points in the past, like some of the connections we made for some of the first sort of legal representation and connections for that the Settlement Act, pursuing land claims, like came out of connections made by our veterans with other Indigenous veterans and other folks who expressed interest in our ongoing claims to theft by the state and federal government. So, I think and then I also think about the economics, the eventual economic transformations in our communities slowly through the 50s and 60s, and these attempts to do that work coming from those who served, right? Who made those sometimes people who served then also got a trade, moved away, like the number of Penobscots in particular that went to Connecticut to work in different factories and different things like that, reflect, I think, connections made through having been in the service and being exposed to some of the other economic opportunities. And so I think I think it is always complicated. And I think that sort of the as Donna has expressed the our version of the ice, the isolation pieces of our work in our communities as a form of intensified underdevelopment, right, within our reservation communities at the behest of the state, in particular for us in the 19th and 20th centuries, becomes the military participation becomes attempts to escape that that we aren't so isolated from that we gain access to and networks that become powerful networks for our self-determination in later times.
Yeah, I do. I just want to go back to what Harold said about the Boston Tea Party and the Pretendians and how Hollywood just took that image over, and how they, when 101st Airborne jumped out of their planes or whatever they called Geronimo, and also it kind of it reminded me when the when they made the raid to get Bin Laden, that operation was called Geronimo. So, I don't, at first I don't really know what to think about that, whether it's a dehumanization or whether it's some sort of honor for us, but I don't know. Just thought I'd throw that out there because it kind of ran through my mind when Harold was talking.
Yeah, if I may comment on that, Donna, because what you just said is exactly sums up the contradictions that I talked about, right? The contradictions is between, I'm not sure what to think of this. Is it A or is it B? But the point is, it's both, right? And we have a notion often about it's either or, and I have a difficulty to comprehend that something can entail both A and B. And that makes the craziness, right? The craziness happens because of that internal contradiction between it's both A and non-A, and both something to feel exploited by, as you just indicated, and something to be proud of. And that's exactly what happened when the 101st Airborne PIR, the Parachute Infantry Regiment, adopted the Apache logo. They went actually to the Apache tribe, who was deeply dispossessed, defeated, in poverty, and asked if they could actually use the term Geronimo. And they said, okay. It was the same thing with the Apache helicopters and the Kiowa helicopters. And so what you see on the one hand, we of course now talk about Tomahawk missiles, right? So on the one hand, you get a denigration of a people and their heritage and an ignorance in the general public about American Indians beyond stereotype. Most people know the stereotype. Many people in, let's say, the land statements that people make, right? We hereby honor that we are on indigenous land. But that's just a small text. What does it really mean? And I think your show, Donna, Wabanaki Windows, is, I think, is an important, it may be a small voice, but it's an important voice that reaches into the general public here in Maine, and perhaps sometimes beyond, to people begin to understand that simply to have a slogan on a wall or a statement before you have a conference, we are here on Wabanaki land, or we're here on Pequot land, or whatever it may be, that's really not enough. It's just not enough to say the prayer, Pax Vobiscum, right? Peace be with you, and then forget all about it when you move on. So these things have to be deeply ingrained in the collective consciousness of people, that when you're talking about legislation, for example, and you elect legislators, that these people are actually asked, A, do you actually know what you're legislating on, right? And the same thing has to be asked of judges. Repeatedly, American Indians and Canadian Indians find themselves in the courts, federal courts, state courts, district courts, you name it. And you're dealing with attorneys and attorneys general who are stunningly ill-informed about indigenous people. We saw that with the Penobscot River case. You see a federal judge, and I said to the legal team for the Penobscot Nation at the time, if that judge is lazy, we will lose. And the guy was lazy because he didn't immerse himself in the indigenous history of the dispossession of the Penobscot Indian Nation. And so you saw that repeatedly. And I'm, as an educator like Darren, you know, that's why we teach, that's why we do this show. You try to reach to people, not just the already informed, but hopefully, and that's of course the harder part, that the people who don't know actually will tune in and actually begin to make an effort to understand those complex issues. And to me, the frustrating thing on the one hand is that very important people who have their hands on the levers of power willfully or whatever explains their ignorance are making rulings about people's lives, and they don't know what they are talking about. And we are asked, when they have their robes on, to actually pay respect to these people in these black robes, because I'm using the term black robe here in kind of crazy way about the Jesuit missionaries here, but these people don't know. Many people don't know, and that is stunning to me, that they have the arrogance to make rulings on things they don't know. And that's why we continue to educate and have to educate from generation to generation.
Okay, Darren, I'll just say, so I know you want to say something about that, but I think we need to get into the actual soldiers involved in these wars. But Darren, go ahead.
Oh, well, I have so many things to say, but I do agree we should focus on those who have fought and specific leaders. And I know, I think my connection here would be, again, the complicatedness around the honorifics. Like, if we think about that playing Indian, dressing up as Indians, right, which we have in the Maine, in the context of Maine, you know, we have the books Liberty, like the Liberty Men and Great Proprietors, that book by Alan Taylor talks about, you know, the late part of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century, that those who were resisting those great proprietors from Boston, you know, they also assumed the Indian identity. They called themselves the White Indians of Maine as a form of organizing against what they saw as the interests of the elite, which I think is just an interesting, if we think about our current politics and the ways in which people are organizing against elitists and how they mobilize certain forms of nationalism vis-a-vis indigenous people or not indigenous people. I think that that's a really important part of it. I think one thing that we see recently, and so this is me jumping the gun for Donald, who could not make it, and I think Donna, was the naming of the Maine National Guard target range in the honor of two Passamaquoddy World War I veterans, Charles Alola and Samuel Dana, recently. Again, as I think the specifics in honoring those people is really important, as is, I believe, remind me on this, Harold, like they named one of the ferry boats after Charles Shea, as well, and I think mobilizing and honoring our veterans was what, we engaged in this walk recently. We do, the work in our communities to do this and bring these people, their specific names forward is a really important part of our collective history and honoring elders and veterans. I think it gets mixed up though into this thing where you have the Apache helicopter, you have the American intentional uses of us as indigenous people to further their own interests, right? Which is often about building empire and doing things with our names that we might not agree with. But I think it's a really interesting, complex situation. But I do want to point that out, that that honorific came through in the last, Don, I believe Donald said, just in the last month or last month. So there is this, I think, us telling the stories of our veterans as Wabanaki people is a really important thing. I think you see that being picked up by others in this context. But yeah, I'll start the discussion there, and maybe Harold has a lot more information on specifics. But I just wanted to bring that to our attention, that it's both honoring and also at times, what is it saying to us, or to people who are not involved, who aren't, Harold, as you mentioned, who might be lazy and not think about, like, oh, what are the specific causes of, if you think about what's happening in Passamaquoddy during World War I and how the intensification of poverty in places like that was happening in and around that era, like, how do we honor those people? Truly, how do we honor them beyond the naming of things? So.
Harold.
Yeah, so we talked about it before, but there is a Penobscot elder now 101 years old, in living currently in Normandy. And some of you have seen a film that hasn't been officially released yet, a documentary film called Little Muskrat, a Penobscot Indian Hero. That's a 22-minute film about Charles Shea, who not only served as a medic in World War II, he was drafted like his three brothers, but he also served in the Korean War, got three bronze battle stars there because he was in major conflicts out there, and so forth and so on. And the reason we made that documentary film, but directed by Alejandro Torres of Yaqui Indian descent from California, but he lives in Maine. He really grabbed hold of that story because that story allows us in a short while to tell a very complicated story. And in this case, focusing on Charles, but Charles, as I have often mentioned, is not about Charles in so much as it is about all these other people. I mentioned Jim Thoma, the Maliseet, former Maliseet chief basket maker, but we can mention so many other people. Joseph Francis, who is Kelvin Francis' father, who got the Silver Star in the Korean War, lost his toes because of frostbite at Chosin Reservoir. We could talk about another another Dana who's related to the Dana who was just recently honored because of World War One, who was killed in battle in the Korean War, Passamaquoddy. In particular, I have a huge file on Native Americans and particularly Wabanaki in the Korean War. That file got chewed by my dog. Donna remembers Kaya chewing my flash key, but it had precious information on it. And I'm trying to find out how to rescue some of it. But part of it was rescued for the purposes of that documentary that I just mentioned that will be aired later on public television, main public television, on Maine Veterans Day, we were told, but we will hope to have it accessible for individual viewers. Some of you already, I think Darren and Donna have seen the film already. But again, the purpose of that was that Charles, as a medic, was in a way a method for us to draw attention to people like Melvin Neptune. The name has been mentioned before. But Melvin, one of five brothers who served remarkably, all descendants of Lieutenant Governor John Neptune. But Melvin, who fought in North Africa, was wounded, fought in Sicily, and then fought in Normandy, was again wounded later, got the Bronze Star for heroism, landed also in Omaha Beach. And I think I've mentioned before, Leslie Banks got the Silver Star in Northeast France, very severely wounded in the Battle of the Bulge, came severely handicapped back and restored his health to a degree. But of course, he's the father of John Banks, who was a long time, very wonderful servant, if you will, of the Penobscot Nation and particularly the Penobscot River. And I was honored actually at the funeral of Leslie in Portland at the veterans section, to give actually a talk about Leslie Banks in World War II. He landed on Omaha a few days after Charles. Then we talk about Phil Neptune. Most people don't even know. I was in communication with Wayne Newell, who recently passed away, amazing Passamaquoddy leader, as all of you know. But he was an uncle of Wayne Newell. But Phil Neptune was also a medic, also landed on Omaha Beach, but was killed about 10 days later in heavy combat in Normandy. And I'm just mentioning some of these names. I know a lot, as you know, many, many names. I tracked them. I've contacted the families in many cases, in case they didn't know how their beloved ones died and were often buried overseas. Not all their bodies came back. And talking about death, very few Penobscot today, and let alone the people in the state alone, know the name David Lewis, Penobscot Indian, killed in combat in Northeast France in 1944, after crossing the Moselle River in heavy, heavy combat, was temporarily buried in Northeast France, and then his body was repatriated for honorary burial at Indian Island. So these troop ships that sent troops overseas and then returned with the survivors, then 3 years after the war, two, 3 years after the war, many of these troop ships were used to bring the coffins back by the thousands from Europe back for reburial in this country. And so when we think about these young men, right, almost all young men between 17, 18, and sometimes as old as 30, all their lives were cut off and they came back in caskets. And of course, Donna knows that because that was Donna's task in the Vietnam War, right? Keeping track of the casualties. And I often think about people like Charles' nephew, Lawrence Shea, the son of Billy Shea, Billy who served in the Navy in the Pacific, but his son was killed, his oldest son was killed in Vietnam. And so we have so many of these names that are simply a name on a list, and that's about it, right? And so not just honoring the people who fell or were wounded, but also all the people who have carried the scars throughout their lives.
Right, and I, speaking of that, you know, there are so many that we know the names and we don't know the story. And I think that one of the things with the exhibit at the Abbey Museum for the In the Shadow of the Eagle exhibit is veterans are part of that exhibit, and it's ongoing, us trying to find out the stories from the family. So, the you know, we do have some, but we're we're learning more and we're putting more up in the exhibit. But there's a, and I mentioned this article in the Bangor Daily before, and it's dated September 25th, 1944, and it gives pictures of the Wabanaki soldiers who served in Penobscot and Passamaquoddy. But there's a couple of women here, and I just want to read in Penobscot, there's Josephine Sapier. She served, and Ida Francis, and oh, Catherine Phillips. So for Passamaquoddy women, I see Susan Sacoby. That's all I know. There's others. It's not here though. But I just wanted to mention those just to get their names out there.
Yeah, well, if I may briefly mention, Donna, because you were involved when we made that list a long time ago in 2007, I think. We made a list of the Wabanaki who served in World War II. And I have here the list for. Do you terribly mind if I actually read quickly the list? Because it's kind of interesting. We talk about names, and people may recognize some of the names.
Sure.
There are, yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
So this is the list that was made with Donna and Donald Soktoma. So Donna Loring, Donald Soktoma, and Charles Shea and myself. And that was a list that was made for purposes of the Native American Veterans Day that has been declared for 21st of June. And that day was chosen because of the day of Joseph Orono, as we talked about before. But there were in total 67 Passamaquoddy in World War II that we have, 57 of those from Pleasant Point, 12 from Indian Township, were 58 minimally Penobscot, 18 Maliseet, 30 Mi'kmaq from Maine. In total, that we have is about 160. And they have Christy Altvater, Pleasant Point. I will not mention all their associations because that takes too long. But Christy Altvater, Alexander Bailey, Clarence Baker, Leslie Banks, George Bassett, Kenneth Bassett, Roy Bassett, Clarence Bear, Oliver Bernard, Peter Brisk, Isaac Kaplan, Lawrence Coffin, Ralph Dana, Frank Denny, Lionel Ennis, Philip Francis, Clarence Francis, Daniel Francis, Donald Francis, Frank Francis, Frederick Francis, George Francis, Harry Francis, Henry Francis, Ida Francis, Jerome Francis, Leonard Francis, Merle Francis, Paul Francis, Philip Francis, Ralph Francis, Ronald Francis, Sebattis Francis, Willie Gordius, Ernest Goslin, Peter Hamilton, Robert Hamilton, Michael Holmes, Gilbert Ketchum, Archie Lacoute, Sebattis Louis, David Lewis, Francis Lola, Francis Lollar, Leon Lollar, Eugene Loring, Everett Loring, George Loring, Kenneth Lounge, James Martin, Arthur MacDonald, Tom MacDonald, Walter Meador, Joseph Millier, Patrick Millier, Anthony Mitchell, John McGee Mitchell, John Mitchell, Peter Mitchell, Sebattis Mitchell, Fred Moore, Joe Moore, Arthur Moulton, Lawrence Nash, Donald Nelson, John Nelson, Norman Nelson, Peter Nelson, Philip Neptune, Clement Neptune, Fernald Neptune, Harrison Neptune, Melvin Neptune, Susan Sacoby, Aloysius Newell, Leo Newell, Kelvin Nicholas, John Nicholas, Joseph Nicholas, Louis Nicholas, Fred Nicola, Ralph Nicola, Walter Ogden, Charles Paul, Lawrence Paul, Louis Paul, Raymond Paul, Romeo Paul, Frederick Purley, Pius Purley, Catherine Phillips, Clifford Phillips, Frank Phillips, Freeman Phillips, Horace Polchies, Alexander Ranko, Anthony Ranko, Irving Ranko, Nicholas Ranko, Percy Ranko, Norman Robshaw, David Sapiel, Nicholas Sapiel, Arthur Sapier, George Sapier, George Josephine Sapier, Bert Nose Solis, Shannon Solis, Lauren Shea, Patrick Shea, Thomas Shea, Philip Snow, Harold Sockerbazin, Philip Sockerbazin, Richard Sockerbazin, Charles Sokobe, Raymond Sokobe, Jacob Sock, Byron Sockalexis, Lauren Sockalexis, Frederick Sacobasin, Henry Sacobasin, Henry Sacobi, Susan Sacobi, Newell Soctoma, Simon Soctoma, Theodore Solomon, John Stanley, George Stevens, James Stevens, Lawrence Stevens, Dennis Stone, John Thomas, Anthony Toma, George Toma, Joseph Toma, Louis Toma, Raymond Toma, George Toma, Anthony Tomer, Edgar Tomer, Eugene Tomer, Pius Tomer, Wilfried Tomer, and that's the list. And the reason I mention these lists, because people kind of, when they get the roll call, right, this is a kind of a roll call, a number of them were women, as Donna just reminded us, who also served, and were also Native American women in World War I. Many of them were nurses, and all with the rank of lieutenant. It's, people have forgotten that too.
Yeah, interesting. I think, I also think Nina Neptune was in the military. There are others. I don't know, but there are others, and it'd be nice to hear from the families and let us know who they are. You know, contact someone at the Abbey so we can get the story. So Harold, you got some interesting stories about a few of these veterans, if you want to.
Yeah, I mentioned Leslie Banks. Leslie, like Charles and many others, were replacement soldiers, unlike Melvin. Melvin Neptune volunteered in 1940, very quickly together with the brother of the wife of Lauren Shea, Billy Shea. He sadly died just before they shipped out to England. But if you follow their narratives, their stories, I'll quickly tell you something about Leslie Banks, because he was beloved, as many people know, in the Penobscot community, but not that many people know about his Silver Star. In fact, I interviewed him at the time to have him nominated as a Chevalier in the Legion of Honor, and that would have happened if there had not been some bureaucratic hiccup. So I really felt sad that he passed away before he was about to receive his Legion of Honor. But he served in the 358th Infantry Regiment of the 90th Infantry Division and landed just after D-Day on Omaha. And he was awarded the Silver Star near Metz. And that happened in the fall. And it was a remarkable story that happened, because, and I told that to the family when he was put to his last resting place. And I will say a bit about that particular story, because we talk often about Charles Shea, and that's wonderful, but there are so many other stories that have not been told and have not been shared. But this is about Leslie, if you don't mind that I focus on him, because we can focus on so many others, but that name I would like to mention. From mid-July 1944 onwards, Private Banks was the third Penobscot Indian from the small tribal community in Maine who participated in the liberation of France. He trucked to the front line, joined the 90th Division's 358th Regiment, replacing a machine gunner who had become a casualty of war while fighting in that regiment's Delta Company, a heavy weapons unit. Armed with a 30-caliber water-cooled machine gun, the 19-year-old Private Banks soon found himself in serious combat. Born at Indian Island on the 23rd of December 1924, Leslie Banks was drafted as an 18-year-old enlisted man on the 9th of April 1943 in Bangor. After basic training as an infantryman, first becoming an expert with a carbine, and almost half a year later as a heavy machine gunner, Private First Class Banks left the United States on a troop ship on the 2nd of July the following year. After landing near the British seaport of Liverpool a week later, he arrived in a replacement depot where it was determined that he would join the 90th Infantry Division, nicknamed the Tough Hombres, then suffering many casualties as it ran into fierce German resistance in Normandy. Soon he boarded the troop transport ship to the provisional harbor constructed at the Omaha Beach. Having participated in a disastrous attack against a German paratrooper regiment defending the Normandy town of Saint-Germain-sur-Sèvre, suffering many casualties on July 22-23, the 90th Division fought hard at Chambois. By then, Private Banks had taken his frontline position in one of his regiment's machine gun squads. closing the Falaise Gap in mid-August, his division captured 12,000 enemy soldiers in about 1 week. As part of Patton's Third Army, they then raced towards Lorraine in northeastern France, passed through the Argonne Forest, reaching Verdun on the 6th of September. That's where heavy fighting happened, by the way, in World War I. Meanwhile, having survived the Falaise Gap slaughter, retreating German troops reorganized themselves in defensive lines along the Moselle River in early September, which is where David Lewis was killed. On the 5th and 6th of September, American troops tried to establish a bridgehead over this river in weak sectors of the German defense in order to launch an assault on the heavily fortified city of Metz and push into the Saar region, but this time enemy resistance proved to be too strong. In the night from 7th to 8th September, Private Banks and fellow troops in the 90th Division were surprised by a swift German counteroffensive by the 106th Panzer Brigade, the Feldherrnhalle. This mobile tank force involving 2,500 enemy troops consisted of about 50 large Panthers and other tanks, as well as 115 half-tracks carrying a battalion of infantry reinforced by additional infantry from the 59th Volksgrenadier Division riding on the tanks. Using speed and surprise in a multi-pronged attack in the darkness of the night, the enemy force split up two parallel moving armored assault troops infiltrating toward the forward positions held by the 90th Division. At the time of the swift assault in the pre-dawn morning hours of 8 September, Leslie Banks' regiment was encamped in near the French city of Mery, about 125 kilometers northwest of Metz. Pushing behind American lines, a confusing and ferocious battle ensued. Quote, by daybreak, the assault group 1 had now centered its attack on the town of Mery. It was held by a battalion of the 358th Infantry, supported by a platoon of 30-inch guns from the 607th Tank Division Battalion, Tank Destroyer Battalion. The Germans first tried a direct assault, resulting in the loss of several tanks, but by then tried to outflank the position with Panzer Grenadiers, only to lose a number of half-tracks to defending fire. But this time, the U.S. defenders had called in artillery fire on the assault group, which pummeled by over 300 105-millimeter rounds from an artillery battalion. The assault group was stalled and had lost 12 Panther tanks and 68 half-tracks. Their fate was sealed shortly thereafter when the 359th launched a battalion-sized counterattack into the flank of the survivors, supported by another tank battalion. The commander of the assault group asked and got permission to withdraw, but it was too late. The assault group was now trying desperately to fight its way out of a pocket by the late afternoon was destroyed. According to the U.S. newspaper article, based on his military citation, Private Banks acted bravely when he took immediate action, stopping an early morning surprise attack from behind, from which he was later awarded the Silver Star, quote, for gallantry in action on the 8th of September in the vicinity of Mery. An enemy force of 30 infantrymen, six heavy tanks, and two half-track vehicles attacked a platoon position. Private First Class Banks observed that the attack was directed toward the platoon anti-tank gun, which was unmanned and was facing in the wrong direction. He raced through 50 yards of intense fire, maneuvered the gun into proper position, and fired a round at the attackers. Despite the intense fire concentrated upon him, he single-handedly loaded and fired two more rounds, which halted the enemy advance. Continuing to operate the gun effectively, he helped force the attackers into a hasty retreat. Private First Class Banks' gallantry was in accordance with high military tradition, end quote. It was cited in the Bangor Daily News of the 1st of May, 1946. So I just want to mention this because here is this extraordinary feat of heroism awarded with the Silver Star. But just a few months later, he was very severely wounded by shelling of a German Panther in the Battle of the Bulge. And I could talk about Leon Lollar, also Silver Star, promoted to Staff Sergeant, great hero in the Battle of the Bulge, and so forth and so forth. There's many, many of those stories are there.
Well, that's what the show is about. So if you want to talk, you want to give us some more stories, that's fine. That'd be great. Get some more, otherwise.
Anyway, it's a, okay. okay, I'll then quickly on Lollar a little bit, yeah? So okay. Leon Lollar, on the 3rd of August, Penobscot from Indian Island landed in Normandy. Leon Lollar coming ashore on Utah Beach, He fought in C Company, 318th Infantry Regiment, 80th Infantry Division. They were inserted into the line immediately, engaging the Germans in Evron and Saint-Suzanne, Argentan. They were also active in the Falaise pocket, like Leslie Banks. Assigned to the 3rd Army's 80th Division, this division moved swiftly across France to the Seille River. In Normandy, in November 1944, they found him in the Saar Basin, and in December, they attacked the Siegfried Line. When the Germans began their Ardennes offensive, the Battle of the Bulge, the 80th with Leon moved north to Luxembourg, slamming into the German line southeast of the Bastogne, the famous besieged town of Bastogne. These infantrymen, supported by the 4th Armored Division, tried to break the siege. Proving himself a natural leader in combat, Lollar was promoted to Staff Sergeant. On Christmas Day, the 25th of December, Staff Sergeant Lollar's regiment fought near Chaumont, Belgium, just 11 kilometers south of Bastogne. The 80th Division had say, sorry, by the end of the campaign, this gets too detailed. In Luxembourg, Sergeant Lollar was wounded on the 27th of January, 1945, and by orders of Major General McBride, was awarded the Purple Heart. And then the last story I will share, because there's many more, it was on David Lewis, I mentioned before, was killed in combat. After Old Town High School, David Lewis worked in South Portland in the New England Shipbuilding Corporation, like where many other Penobscots were working at the time. He was drafted in October 1943 in Brewer. After basic training at Camp Blanding in Florida, the 32-year-old Private Lewis shipped to Europe in June 1944. On the 6th of July, exactly 1 month after Charles and Melvin had landed on Omaha Beach, his Penobscot Indian rifleman set foot on Omaha Beach. He served in the 320th Regiment Infantry attached to the 35th Infantry Division. That infantry regiment was smashing through France, driving the enemy back east and mopping up pockets of German resistance. The summer weather that fall was beautiful. After a battle near Nancy, his regiment took the towns of Chaudon, Jeanville, Pithiviers, and Courtenay, Troyes, and then crossed the Seine, seizing a bridge intact and liberated Bar-sur-Seine on August the 30th, Joinville on September 3, and numerous smaller localities. Together with their sister regiments, David Lewis's regiment liberated the city of Montargis and then established a bridgehead across the Moselle River. Pushing north across the streams and canals in the season's first rains and against bitter opposition, David Lewis's regiment cut the main highway leading east from Nancy to Germany and pursued the Nazis into the wooded and rough terrain beyond. On August 30th, the regiment reached the Seine River, seizing a bridge intact. My notes are kind of discombobulated. Crossing the Moselle River on September 13th, the 34-year-old Penobscot warrior was killed in action. His parents survived him, David Lewis Sr. and his mother Stella Lewis, both of Indian Island. And then he was buried, of course, like many of these troops nearby, right? And later were retrieved by special units to disinter the bodies, and they came into major mass graves, but all tagged with dog tags, and then were later retrieved after the marking was made. And then David Lewis was among the thousands of soldiers whose bodies were returned back. And so I have actually the name of the ship on which David Lewis came back. And then veterans who survived World War II were part of the honor guard from St. Anne's Church on Indian Island for the interment. It was a very moving story because he was a single child. And so one reason, because he didn't have siblings and parents were elderly, it's one of those names that kind of has been forgotten. And yet he fell overseas. And I've always felt sorry for him because he had such a promising start and kind of, you know, it petered away into a sad casualty among the thousands and thousands.
Yeah. Well, thanks. So we have a few more minutes left. And Darren, do you want to say anything towards the end of this? Or?
I mean, I shared some of the story just of my own father's service in Korea. You know, I think, and, you know, this is just a small story of just like a number of other Wabanaki veterans. You know, he served as a medic in Korea, actually joined the Navy to avoid the draft, as far as I can tell, during the Korean conflict. Tested well, was put in, as a corpsman, in that service, and served his first 2 years of service in Navy hospitals before being transferred to advanced units with Marines, serving as a corpsman medic with during Korea, and associating with MASH units and that sort of thing. That and then his final assignment being transferred to a special troop that were involved in a nuclear test, doing military exercises during a nuclear test, as his last assignment. So, I think those are the costs of and opportunities of service in a very small scale from my own family perspective. I think I'd probably say more, but that's just one small story. He was always jealous of me for traveling the world, quote unquote, because I was an academic, nerdy kid with all these opportunities he never had. But he traveled the world through the service and saw a lot of the world. Again, this is, part of the experience for within our families, within our communities, of people seeing the world, bringing that back to our community, trying to make that as an enrichment to our families and communities as well.
So I think that the fact that we've had a lot of our ancestors serve has really created a pathway for us to travel and to do things as well.
That's right.
There's some really great things, so we owe them a tremendous amount. Okay, so I want to thank our guests, Professor Harold Prince and Professor Darren Ranko, for being on the show today. Thank you for joining us. I'm your host, Donna Loring. And you've been listening to Abenaki Windows. The music for our show is by Rolf Richter, a track called Little Eagles from his CD Dreamwalk. The engineers for our show are Jessica Lockhart, WMPG, and Joel Mann of WERU. Tune again next month for another Wabanaki Windows.